this is only related because it's about French toast, but a very interesting style of French toast that I learned from Nigel Weber at Nate, like when I was a student in culinary school at Nate. And yeah. So instead of like, sorry, a very different style of bread pudding. Officially, it's a different style of bread pudding. So instead of cubing up bread, tossing it with the milk and egg and letting it soak, you basically make like a creme anglaise, or like pretend you're making...
ice cream?
Yeah, sorry, not a creme anglaise. So not a stirred custard, but like a set custard. Like you're making the mix for creme brulee. Uh-huh. And then you just shingle nice little, say, triangles of the stale bread into the casserole or whatever dish you're using. And then pour the custard mix so that it comes like halfway up or so the bread.
Right.
And you can let it sit, but then like to soak, but then you'll bake it like that and set it like a custard. And so you end up with pure custard, soaked bread, like French toast style. And then like this bit of partially soaked toast that peaks above the layer of custard. And then you can, I can't remember if we did this or not, but like you could totally like dust those with sugar and brulee them or something like that. And it was such an interesting, like it's very simple, but it was just a very different approach, and it made for a really unique and beautiful, bread pudding.
Totally. That's basically exactly what I'm doing, except I am soaking the bread and I'm shingling it in and then layering it like that. So it's like basically actual pieces of toast. I'm going to use brioche or challah if I can get it, but I think it'll be easier to get brioche. And then, so I'm like soaking the pieces like you would for French toast, and then taking them out and shingling them into the pan like that. Mm-hmm. And then I'm taking the rest of the custard and just pouring it in so that it like comes part way up, and then baking it like about halfway with foil on top, but then taking the foil off and then letting the top like get crispy.
You can get challah at Bliss Baked Goods.
That's a great idea. It's pretty close to my house too, so. I haven't been there in a while. It's still open.
When's the last time
you were there?
I just assume so. Like I would go there occasionally when I was at June's, because they had some, like the owners are Jewish, and so they would
have.
That's
not that long ago. That's like a year ago or something.
Yeah, like they had
a year and a bit.
Yeah. We would for some items use their marble rye and their challah, and they also make knishes now that I'm thinking about it.
Oh, cool. Yeah, great bakery. You ready for this?
I'm ready if you're ready.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my co-host, Alan Sutterby. Hey, Alan.
Hi, Shale.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. And this is our holiday spectacular. jingle.
Was the Halloween one called Spooktacular?
I don't remember what it was called. Okay, probably. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was called Spooktacular. Halloween Spooktacular. Well, this is the holiday spectacular.
Yeah.
Kind of lands like pretty far away from the actual like Christmas holiday this year, but I'm sure some years it will fall much closer. This is just going to be the last episode before that whole thing happens. So,
right. Yeah. And so that's why we're both sitting here in our ugly sweaters with Christmas lights all around us, drinking eggnog. And
yeah, I'm actually drinking a stout. It's quite good. Yeah.
Water for me.
Why, Alan? Don't you normally drink something during our recording?
Not usually.
Oh, just once in a while?
Once in a while, yeah.
This is officially the first time for me that I've had an alcoholic beverage while we've been recording.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, but it seemed appropriate since it's like a holiday party.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And what a party it is.
Oh, my goodness. Unbelievable. That is an amazing Santa hat you're wearing, Alan.
That's my hair.
Oh, shoot. Well, it looks good.
Thanks.
Do we have some follow-up to go over, Alan?
Yeah, really,
we do.
Really important follow-up. At the beginning of our last conversation, we spent quite a while talking about plating beans, about putting beans on a plate. And so I felt I owed it to everyone to let them know how that resolved itself.
So you actually put beans on a plate?
No, I used the ramekins. just like you said.
Dang. Next day, walked in, checked the ramekin numbers, and they're like, phew.
Yeah. But, and so I thought, like, if that were a dish on an a la carte menu, like, it couldn't just be lamb and beans. I would need other components to kind of flesh it out. But because it was part of a 4 or 5 course meal paired with wines, for this entree, we really did just serve like braised lamb shank glazed with sauce, and then this pot of beans on the plate. The like beans with dried tomato and kale and some veal stock and a nice gratin on top. And so I was a little bit worried when we were going to make the first plates that it would look very it do look brown. Too sparse and simple. Oh, okay. And but it actually looks Shale, don't make fun of me, but it kind of reminded me of something that might get served at Bouchon. Like,
oh, cool.
It was like this big, beautiful piece of meat glazed with sauce, and then we put like a whole bunch of herbs all over it, like little pieces of chive and chervil and tarragon and parsley and basil and stuff. And then a little doily, and then this awesome little ramekin of beans with a really dark, crusty gratin on top, like kind of, not really, but kind of reminiscent of French onion soup. It looked cool.
Sweet.
And it
looked
it
like French bistro food.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Awesome.
So,
but cute French bistro food with all the like cute little herb garnishes and things.
But I made notes on all your suggestions for how to actually put beans on a plate, and I will try them soon enough.
Yeah, that's definitely going to come in handy someday, I'm sure. All those random weird suggestions, like maybe if you make it a super flat bean puree.
Well, I do like using beans, like certainly at home, but even at work, and like one of the dishes that we do that you didn't get a chance to see, like our vegetarian entree, is the roasted butternut squash, and it has beans on the right on the plate, beans cooked in cranberry juice.
Cranberry beans cooked in cranberry juice.
Yeah. So if you remember the original, when we talked about it, I was like, yeah, I'm going to use these beans called cranberry beans. At the time, I think you said you hadn't heard of them, and I forgot to follow up with you.
Man,
the other
Alan,
name
you have
such for
a sharp
them?
Memory. It's scary to me sometimes.
Sorry. Thank you.
No, that's good. Someone has to be our historian.
Exactly, yeah. There's a much more common name for cranberry beans, and it's Romano beans, which you've heard
okay.
of.
Yeah.
But we ended up just for flavor's sake, we ended up like making, it's a pretty straightforward like baked bean recipe, only we use cranberry juice, just because it seemed to play into the other ideas and flavors on that plate, as like, because we had all these kind of like Eastern North American ingredients like corn and squash and beans and and cranberry just fit well there too.
Yeah. You ever been to a cranberry bog?
I don't think so. No,
I don't
know
think so either, but I've definitely seen a few on TV. Maybe Alton Brown went to a cranberry bog. I can't remember.
And there certainly are cranberry bogs around where I was born,
really?
north of Toronto.
Cool.
But I never visited one. I've never. Yeah, it'd be cool to see the flooding of the bogs, like the way that they.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I've had a lot of weird jobs, but I've never had a job where I had to wear like hip waders.
Waders?
I always thought it would be fun to have a job where I had to wear hip waders.
Or terrible, depending on the.
Well, yeah. Fun for a week. Like, I wouldn't want to do it for a really long time. But yeah, like, I don't know. Like, like pulling in oyster nets or something like that.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or fishing cranberries out of a bog. I don't know. That might be fun.
Sounds, we're probably idealizing those jobs a great deal or romanticizing them.
No, like, I mean, yes and no. I don't know.
Oysters sounds
like
hard.
I'm sure it's hard work, and I'm sure that, yeah, if you had to go and do it every single day. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I think it might be fun.
You could have your own Food Network TV show where you go and
what's, do dirty like that food jobs.
That Lynn Crawford one.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
I can't remember what it was called, but she's like, I'm a chef and I lost my passion. So now I'm going to go and like see what it's like
learn
to raise
to
pigs
grow
this week.
Oysters.
And, yeah.
Yeah. Totally. If I ever lose my passion, Alan, that's what I'll do. Except it'll be a podcast, not a TV show.
Oh, I see. Wait a minute. Does that mean you've lost your passion already? No. Shale.
No. This podcast is my passion, Alan.
Good.
Boom. And making ice cream.
Did you? So, sorry, that was the bean follow-up. Did you have anything you needed to address?
Yeah, I have a piece of follow-up, but I just one more question about the bean dish. Did you taste it? Did it? It sounds very rich to me. Was mm-hmm. there something to balance that?
Yeah, or? The dried tomatoes. So it was like oven dried tomatoes that were put in a very low oven overnight. And so mm-hmm. they had like, yeah, that's the acid and the brightness that helps balance the dish. Yep.
Cool. When you say a low oven, you mean like the one that's under the range?
Yeah, exactly. The ones you have to crouch down to get to, yeah.
Yeah, those are the best ones for drying tomatoes. Okay, well, I have one quick piece of follow-up. On the last episode, I mentioned that I'm not really super into the intro. Mm-hmm. And I've been sending the final cut basically before we post it on the feed to my brother Ryan to listen to mm-hmm. Just to tell me if there are any weird editing errors or anything that sounds bad or anything. Mm-hmm. He's got a good ear for that kind of stuff, and he likes listening to the podcast, so he's eager to get his hands on it as soon as he can. So I usually send it to him a couple days ahead of time. Mm-hmm. And for those who aren't aware, he and I co-wrote the theme song together for right. Food Court. Mm-hmm. And when I sent it to him, the last episode to him, I was basically like complaining about how I don't like the intro. And he took that to mean that I don't like the music.
Oh.
So I just wanted to set the record straight about that. I actually really love our theme song. Mm-hmm. I totally dig it and I'm proud of it. It was really fun to write it and I'm super stoked about it. What I don't like about the intro is the stuff that I say. And I
feel
like
there's
some room.
You mean the stuff that happens between Welcome to Food Court and We're Gonna Talk About It?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That stuff in there, I gotta punch it up. One of these days, I'm going to punch it up, Alan.
So how much time passed between when Ryan listened and misunderstood what you meant and when it finally all came out in the open and you guys were on the same page? Because I'm picturing like a kind of like Frasier-style sitcom misunderstanding where this is protracted. You guys are talking about two different things and then eventually you realize.
Yeah, I'm not really sure how much, like, I'm not really sure how off the rails things went on his end. You know, like after he heard that, like whether he then like, you know, threw his listening device in the garbage and then vowed never to speak to the producers of the podcast again, and then
set your Christmas like, present on fire,
and then you set my Christmas present on fire. Mm-hmm. But it was about 5 days before I actually talked to him about it.
Okay.
And it was just, I think it was just yesterday that I talked to him about it, and he was asking me about the episode. He said he really liked the episode. He was like, but you don't like the song? I was like, no, I love the song, I just great. Don't like what I say during it. He was like, oh. Yeah. So that was pretty funny. Just accidentally insulting people all over the podcast. Yeah, and then I also have a plug. Oh, sorry. Did you have something else to say?
I was just going to say, think of all the times you insulted someone and they didn't confront you about it. That's all.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or all the times that I've said something that someone would consider insulting, but they'll never hear it because they'll never listen to the podcast. Right. That's awesome. and I also have a plug for something that I'm doing, and it's kind of a weird plug, and I meant to plug it last episode and I should have. And the reason why it's weird is because it's happening today. If you're listening to this on the day that this episode of the podcast comes out, which is December 15th, 2021, this evening, I'm going to be doing an online cooking demo via Zoom, and it's a charity demo to promote or to raise funds for a charity called Breakfast Club of Canada, and they provide breakfasts in schools for kids who don't necessarily get a breakfast before coming to school in the morning. Mm-hmm. And the demo that I'm doing is called Breakfast for Dinner, so it's topical in that way. And if you make a donation, you get a link, and you can join in and watch me cook breakfast for dinner today. If you and if you Google Breakfast Club of Canada, I think it's on their front page, but I'll also put a link to the sign up page in our show notes. So if you check the show notes, see there's a link there. If you want to see me worried about how long it's going to take me to cook a frittata in my home kitchen over Zoom, feel free to join
it
at
home.
Yeah, we're doing it from my place. Because I think, like, for most of the people that are going to sign up for it, they're going to be cooking in their home kitchen. And the only other real option was for me to cook at the Kind Kitchen. Mm-hmm. But the equipment that we have there is not necessarily the same type of equipment that most people would have in their house. And so it just made more sense to do it in my home kitchen, because then it's more like, you know, the equipment that I have will, you know, make more sense to more people who are going to sign up for it.
Mm-hmm. So the idea, like, people, the idea is that participants are cooking alongside you at home.
Yeah, and there's an ingredients list. If you sign up, there's an ingredients list that you get. I mean, if you're signing up and you're planning on joining in this evening, you've got some shopping to do. but yeah, there's an ingredients list and some recipes and some instructions and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You know, but you wouldn't need to necessarily cook along. But yeah, right. You certainly can. And there's also there's like a cocktail component. So there's like a cocktail component that starts at like 4:30 Mountain Time. And I'm going to be making three cocktails and or showing you how to make three cocktails. And then there's like the dinner portion of it is from 5:15 to 7 p.m. And each of those is a $25 donation.
Cool.
Yeah.
And the cocktails are breakfast themed?
Sort of. Yeah. Should I spill the beans on what they are?
Well, it's up to you. No, I mean, you can. I'm interested to know, but you
might as well. It's happening tonight. So. the cocktails are a virgin Michelada, which I'm making with kombucha instead of beer.
What's a Michelada?
It's like, well, there are several versions of it, but it's basically like it's like a spicy beer and tomato juice.
Oh, okay.
It's sort of like a Caesar made with beer or something.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a beer cocktail, but in the vein of a Caesar. Like, that's at least that's the like Canadian American version of it. There are several. It's like, from what I understand, it's actually a Mexican creation, and lots of places in Mexico there's no tomato juice in it. It's like lime and beer and certain spices. But the one that's like sort of been popularized in Canada and the States has tomato juice in it, and so I'm just going to do that one.
Yeah, cool.
And then there's like a white sangria. Mm-hmm. And what's the other cocktail?
A mimosa.
No. It's to go with dessert, and it's a Irish coffee.
Cool.
Yeah. Because, you know, you drink coffee in the morning for breakfast.
Oh, I get it now. Yeah.
Yeah. There's the time.
It sounds fun.
Yeah, it should be great. So what are we here for, Alan? It's the holiday spectacular.
Yeah, we're going to talk about all of our favorite holiday foods and drinks and what we're making this season in our homes. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah, holiday traditions, things that we're going to make, things that we like to make, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are you making this year for the holidays, Alan?
Well,
do you have family coming in from out of town or anything like that for the holidays this year?
No, I think we're, my folks and my brother and sister are in Calgary. And so sometime between Christmas and New Year's, we'll go to Calgary
cool.
for a few days. But yeah, Christmas itself is just me and Lisa and the kids.
Sweet.
And the Christmas season for us kind of starts the first Sunday of December.
Oh yeah.
That's when we put up the tree and we always make hot toddies on that day. So
nice.
We've done that now. But yeah, hot toddy is one of my essential, holiday preparations.
Sweet.
You do. Are you a hot toddy guy or?
I do love hot toddies. I don't wind up making them very often, but yeah,
yeah,
they're great. How do you make them?
I do. It's well, to be honest, it's an adaptation of Alton Brown's recipe.
Okay.
The only differences are, well, actually, surprisingly, I toned down the amount of scotch he uses. I find it extremely boozy, the one that he makes, but, but most importantly, like I really think that like acidity is essential in a hot toddy. Cause it's just like, it's water and sugar and scotch. And so like without the acidity, it is completely imbalanced to me. Mm-hmm. And he just adds like slices of lemon to the pot simmering it. But I add like a controlled amount of lemon juice so that I can like
get the correct amount of acidity
more easily. Yeah. Control the acidity and the balance.
Yeah. Also when you're adding slices of citrus to like a boiling liquid, you get a lot of bitterness from the peel,
which is kind of,
yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there are uses for that pithy flavor, but I don't know. It can be unpleasant. Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. I also really like hot buttered rums. You like those, Alan?
I'm not sure I've ever had one.
Oh man.
Does it and yeah, this will illustrate that I almost certainly have it. Does it have butter in it? Does it really have butter in it?
Or no? Yeah. Or at least I've made them with butter in it before. I don't know. My memory is like, well, as we've alluded to, my memory is horrible. but yeah. I don't exactly remember, but yeah, I think it's something acidic and rum, and then you stir or whisk like melted butter into it.
Does it emulsify?
That's such a great question, Alan. I was thinking about that as I was just bringing it up, and I was thinking that like I would probably take a crack at doing that this year and like do it in a Vitamix and see if I could get it to like stabilize. Somehow.
Right. Yeah.
I wouldn't want to put like a bunch of stabilizer in it where it would be like thick or anything like that. But if I if I could figure out a way to emulsify it, that would be awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Follow up for next time. I'll let you know.
Sure. Yeah. There's, I was reading the Boondock, menu recently and they have a cocktail called, Boulangerie. That has brown butter in it. And I don't know how it's like incorporated or if it's like they get the flavor without actually using butter or what, but it has brown butter and it had like some other bread component, like breadcrumbs or something on it. Like, and I haven't tasted it or seen it or heard anything else about it. I just literally read it on their menu, but it really caught my eye. It sounded very, very interesting.
Cool. That's interesting. Yeah. There's like a couple ways that you could incorporate brown butter flavor into something. Like, I mean, like one of the things for sure is a fat wash. Do you know what a fat wash is? You take some alcohol and you mix it with a fat that you want to impart the flavor from into it. And, I mean, I haven't done it tons. I'm not a bartender and I don't know a ton about cocktails. But yeah, like I know that there's a technique called fat wash where you mix your alcohol with some type of fat that you're trying to incorporate the flavor from. So whether that be like coconut oil or something like that, and then you strain out the fat, like you either solidify the fat by chilling the mixture and then strain it out, or you let it separate and then scoop the fat and then skim the fat off the top or whatever. And then you have the, you know, like your booze, and it's flavored with whatever flavor was in the fat. And so that's probably one way that you could incorporate the brown butter flavor into your alcoholic beverage. The other way would be to take all of it. So make brown butter and then take the milk solids out of it.
Right. Yeah.
And just use those, blend those into whatever liquid or make a syrup out of it. I've made brown butter syrups actually before and they work really well. You just take out most of the fat. Really good way to do that actually is to, so you make brown butter, but you add a bunch of milk powder to it. So you get a whole bunch of extra solids, and then you take those solids and blend them into whatever it is that you want to flavor, and you get like a really crazy brown butter flavor. So you can make like a really good brown butter syrup in that way.
Yeah. I was going to suggest that maybe you wouldn't even actually need butter to make a brown butter flavor. You would just need like milk powder or whey powder or something, and then to toast it up. But
yeah, it's funny. Like it, when you toast it in the oven, it doesn't quite have the same flavor. It doesn't quite have the same characteristic. Yeah. There's something about frying it in the oil that gives it like part of its nuttiness, but
yeah, I can see it being amazing in cocktails because it's kind of like, it's kind of reminiscent of like some nut liqueurs in a way, like the aroma of it. So
man, we should make a brown butter liqueur.
We should
and market it.
Okay.
How good
would
that
be? Cut this part out of the recording so no one's...
Don't worry, I will.
Million
Nobody knows.
Okay.
If you're listening to this and you heard me say that, I'm going to know if you try to steal my idea.
Sean Hicks will have one on the shelves next week.
Oh my God.
He's probably already made it.
Yeah, exactly. It's probably already in his cupboard. Okay, so hot toddies. You made hot toddies. So far, I haven't done a single... Well, is that true? I've basically done zero holiday decorating or anything up to this point.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
You're a real Grinch.
Yeah, I'm a super Grinch. It's already... I'm not going to say when we're recording this. It's a secret. Just kidding. It's the 6th of December right now. And yeah, part of me was like really wanted to put up the Christmas lights on the outside of our house on this past weekend of mine, but I didn't. I'll do it this weekend. When's that going to be? Is that too late, Alan? It'll be like the 9th or something.
What? No, that's not too late.
Okay, perfect. Maybe I'm not a Grinch then.
Drinks wise, what do you like during the holidays?
Yeah, so one of my big holiday traditions for like the last 3-4 years has been making this like amazing eggnog. It's so delicious. I don't even like describing it, even is weird, but
can you try?
I'll try. Yeah. It's very different from most eggnogs. And I got the recipe from James Grant. Do you know who James Grant is?
No, I don't think so.
He was he's a bartender who has been the bar manager in several really great cocktail bars in the city. And he also won like a national bartending championship this year, or maybe international.
He's Old Gray Rabbit online.
Yeah, Old Gray Rabbit.
Okay, that's his. Sorry, I've not met him, but I definitely. Yes, I do know who he is.
Yeah, so A couple of years ago, we were working together, and he let me taste this eggnog recipe that he had kind of altered and made.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget off the top of my head, I do have a link to the original recipe that he sort of used to offshoot the recipe that he made. But it has a lot of different types of liquor in it. And the one that really sort of like makes things work is that it has sherry in it.
Right.
What Oloroso.
Kind? Or, okay, yeah.
Or no, maybe it's, yeah, I think it's Oloroso.
I've tasted this. You brought me some.
Yeah, right.
The Christmas I gave you before some, right? COVID yeah. dropped. I thought in my mind that you said it was Amontillado, but maybe I'm totally crazy.
No, actually, I think you're right. I think it is Amontillado.
We'll look into it.
Just like in the Poe story.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Alan, this isn't the Halloween spooktacular. This is the holiday spectacular. Anyways, it gives it this like super nutty characteristic, and like it's really I don't know, floral but earthy kind of delicious flavor. It's so good. I'd never had an eggnog like it, and it's great. So anyways, I make a bunch of it every year, and I'm planning on making a bunch of it again this year and jarring it up. I'll probably bring you a jar, Alan.
Yay.
Yeah,
we'll do a swap.
Yeah, so the eggnog is like sort of my big thing. And I've always really liked eggnog, even like grocery store out of the carton eggnog. I'm just like a sucker for that. I'm not going to be able to drink all that much of it this year, so I'll probably just stick to my fancy one. But yeah, I definitely plan on making a bunch and drinking some of that eggnog.
Yep. How do you incorporate the eggs? Is it just like whole eggs blended in, or do you do something fancy?
No, there's no making a meringue and folding it in or anything like that. It's basically, it's just eggs, sugar, cream, and then all of the booze components. And then you just blend it and strain it.
Yeah. That's the way it should be. I tried all kinds of different, especially for the egg, how to treat the eggs. Those ones where you like whisk the yolks and whisk the whites and fold.
Yeah,
like,
you make a sabayon and then you like start adding things one at a time. I don't know. Yeah, you just wind up with like kind of some foamy egg floating on top of your nog. And then you're kind of getting like two different beverages. You're kind of getting this like airy egg foam and then like the actual like, you know, delicious eggnog underneath. It's just not really my favorite thing. Like when if you drink like the eggnog that I make, if you blend it and then basically drink it right away, you get some foam on top.
Exactly.
And it's nice.
But
it's not like it's not like a separate layer of like egg foam that floats on your whole bowl of nog or whatever.
Have you
ever served eggnog in a big punch bowl, Alan?
No,
neither have I, but I've been to several Christmas parties where that was a thing, and it seems so weird to me.
Why?
I don't know. Just seems weird to have a egg beverage sitting out for that. I know that you can age eggnog for like a year and it's like good to go because there's so much liquor and sugar in it. But yeah. And actually I tried to age some of the eggnog that I made last year and I don't know, it got a bit of an off flavor and I'm not quite sure what happened there because it has a lot of booze in it. So I'm not quite sure what happened, but it wasn't great. I tried some, like, just this past week, I pulled two of the jars out that I made last year, and I had them aging, and they didn't seem, like, they weren't, like, fermenting or anything. They weren't, like, bubbling or anything. There wasn't anything weird happening with them, but they just kind of had, like, I don't know, they didn't have, like, the really nice, bright, and, like, nutty flavors. It was, you know, really muted and kind of like a little bit funky. And I was just like, not that great. So
I did age one for almost a whole year. And it was fantastic. It was
really,
it's hard to explain. I think that I made it quite a bit boozier than I typically would if I were consuming it over a season.
Right.
But it's hard to put into words how it changed, but it seemed more buttery or something.
Really?
After aging. Yeah. Like it definitely didn't, you know, develop weird, cheesy, off flavors and stuff like that. It was really delicious. And I think I was put onto it. There was like Michael Rollman is into that. So on his blog, he does quite a bit of cocktails on his blog.
Oh, cool.
And yeah, he talked about aging the nog.
Oh, well, maybe I'll look at his like aging technique and see if there's something in it that I kind of missed or whatever. But like it might be the, like there's a lot of cream and sugar in the nog, and like it might be the ratio of alcohol. I'm not sure. I'd have to look at his, look at Ruhlman's ratio of alcohol to other ingredients and see if I'm on track. As you approach the actual hall, like, so the you got the hot toddy thing, that's when you do your decorating, but is there something else that you, is there another beverage?
Well, there's one that we make, we actually make it in the summer, and then drink it over the Christmas season. And it's, so it's based on a German preparation called Rumtopf, which just means rum pot. And traditionally they have like a kind of,
that's like pot backwards, top.
Yeah.
I get it.
Top. Yeah, that's right. With an F. It's pot backwards. Pot. Yeah.
Pot.
What they'll do is like they have a crock or some kind of heavy vessel. And then as different fruits come into season, they mix them with a bit of sugar and then layer them in this pot and then keep everything covered with rum. And you do that over the summer. And then by the end, you have this boozy, you have boozy fruit and you have a liqueur.
Cool.
So we used to do that, but then we decided it was actually much better, tasted and looked much better if we did like only one type of fruit in the pot. And so we've made it with quite a few different kinds, but we really like the ones made with our sour cherries, like the sour cherries that we have in our yard. So every August we'll put up the cherry pot, which is just like sour cherry, sugar, and rum. And it sits, in the cellar until Christmas, and then we'll drink the liqueur. We used to have a bunch of friends over on the solstice, and so we would bust it out then, but then drink it at Christmas, and then even like New Year's Day, if there's champagne left over, we'll put a little splash of the cherry liqueur in it.
Nice. Or a cherry.
Yeah, the fruit. Okay, so like in the traditional German preparation, the fruit is a big, like, is at least as important as the liqueur. And so they'll take the fruit and put it on pancakes or whatever. I find the fruit, like, I don't know if it's the tannin and astringency of the fruit in the context of that high alcohol concentration, but I find them like, yeah, quite astringent and not that pleasant.
Do you pit them before you put them in?
We do, yeah. I wonder if that's the smartest thing to do, though, because I like the pits are supposed to contribute a lot of aromatics, and like I think that when they do the ferment for like kirsch, like the cherry spirit, I think that they leave the pits in the mash. That'd be an interesting experiment.
Yeah, that would be something to try. Like another thing to try would be to like just take the fruit and use it for something else where you can, you know, as a component in something else where you can counteract that astringency somehow. But yeah.
Like what would, do you just mean like baking it into a custard or something, or
potentially, or making it into a sauce of some kind, and where you could add some maybe some additional sugar or some fat that might tone down the astringency or something like that. Or
we did try making, what did Lisa make? She made like an alcoholic Slurpee basically with the fruit once. That was fine. It was okay.
Wasn't your favorite.
Wasn't
as good as Norbit's.
Exactly. Yeah. I can't remember if she froze the fruit and then made like a smoothie, or if she just blended the fruit with ice, or I can't remember, but she did some experimenting.
Cool.
With not really moderate success, but
sweet. So you're going to invite me over for some rum top at some point.
Sure. Yeah.
Sweet.
Oh, you might have. I would have sworn that you would have tasted it.
I probably have had some before, actually.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
It's really great. Like, it's just, it's a cherry liqueur. It's not, in terms of the like sweetness, alcohol, flavor, volume, it's not so different than like cherry herring or like a cherry liqueur like that. But mm-hmm. because it's made with ultra ripe fruit, it has really fantastic aromatics. Like, it smells like essence of sour cherry. Yeah,
that's awesome. My folks used to make like a crab apple liqueur.
Okay. Like, yeah,
I don't know about every year, but sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know, like, I have that in the back of my head as smelling super amazing and aromatic. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe they made some other sort of like fruit type liqueurs as well, probably in a similar way to how you make the rum top. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've had really great crabapple ones. I don't think I've made them personally, but actually Will. From Muley's used to make one with crabapple that he let me taste.
I've had his and it's like, delicious. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, really crazy aromatics and... yeah, just like the distilled essence of a crab apple. Yeah. Yeah, really delicious.
Yeah, like not too sweet, but very aromatic, almost like... because crab apples have this like kind of bitterness, like astringent bitterness. And like mm-hmm. if you can sort of like mitigate that and get the fresh flavor of crab apple, they have this like very, I don't know, like fresh... floral kind of characteristic, man. It's so good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sweet. And then what else are you making for Christmas, Alan?
The other one dish that we make every year is potted pork.
Oh, okay.
Which basically like a pork rillette, basically. So mm-hmm. Pork shoulder, like pork blade roast, cooked really, really low and slow. If we have lard, we'll basically just cook it confit. Otherwise, it's just like a really slow braise, and then we'll shred it up and just like rillettes, like heat ramekins, work the shredded meat into a paste, add some of the cooking liquid and lard and mustard and salt and pepper, and then pot it and seal it with a little bit of lard on top. And we'll make this in a fairly big batch because there's over the course of the holidays, there'll be days where either say we're entertaining or like we don't want to cook and we just want to kind of like nosh and enjoy, like Christmas morning. Like, we would
totally
have that for breakfast on Christmas morning so that we can just, you take it out of the fridge and let it warm up a little bit and eat it with toast.
Man, Alan, it's been a long time since I had rillette, and it's like one of my favorite things in the world.
Yeah. You used to make it at Elm. I remember we'd have duck rillette as a canapé quite often.
Yeah. I used to make it a lot.
Yeah. But it's another thing, like, yeah, we only eat it those few weeks, and like, yeah, bust it out for solstice when we're entertaining, breakfast Christmas morning, breakfast New Year's Day. And it's, I mean, it lasts a good few weeks in the fridge if it's made properly. So
totally,
it's just something we enjoy over the whole season.
Sweet. That's great. And you do that every year. And where do you get the pork from? You just go buy a shoulder, or is that a shoulder that you got from a pig that you got?
Yeah, it's usually, with very few exceptions, all the pork that we cook at home is from sides that we get most years from Nature's Green Acres.
Right. That's awesome.
Yeah. And I'll always do, there's like some that just have plain, like a plain thin layer of white lard on top to seal them. But mm-hmm. then for the Christmas morning one, I always try and make like a little artsy one.
Aww.
And I'll put pink peppercorns, use pink peppercorns and dried rosemary to like make these little holly ornamentations on it. And
oh, that's pretty cool. In my mind's eye, I was picturing like a Christmas tree decoration like made out of rosemary leaves or rosemary sprigs. And then when you said pink peppercorns, I was like, oh my god, he's gonna say ornaments on the tree for sure. That's what you should do this year. Make a Christmas tree out of rosemary and then have the pink peppercorns be little ornaments.
I've got like this one jar of, maybe it's from Silk Road, I can't remember, but it's just like, you know, peppercorn melange or something. So it's like pink peppercorns and green peppercorns and black and white peppercorns all in the same jar. Mm-hmm. And I've probably had it for like 10 years, but because the only time I use it is at Christmas, I take out like
pick out the pink peppercorns.
Yeah. To decorate my potted pork. Yeah.
Oh, that's sad because pink peppercorns are actually quite delicious on their own.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, it looks like, well, let me see. Do I have any Christmas I make a food traditions? Mostly the tradition for me on Christmas is like cooking the major components for whatever Christmas meal that we're going to have. And then like lots of other people in the family also then always like contribute some things, like there's my brother's wife and like his family are like pretty straight up Ukrainian.
Okay. Yeah.
And so there's always a bunch of Ukrainian dishes. Like there's usually cornmeal and
Nachinka.
Yes. Is that what did you say? Lachinka?
Nachinka is like the cornmeal casserole.
Yeah. Yeah. And cabbage rolls usually. And
awesome.
Yeah, which is great. Those are usually my favorite parts of the Christmas meal. But I usually make a turkey in some way, and I usually make mashed potatoes and stuffing, dressing. Should we call it dressing? Let's call it dressing.
Sure.
Yeah, mashed potatoes and dressing and some kind of veggie thing, usually a yam thing. So yeah, I make some of the main components or like the traditional components, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Gravy, usually make some kind of cranberry compote, something.
Mm-hmm.
So that's usually like my major contribution. I don't tend to do a ton of baking. It's like making the eggnog. Maybe sometimes I'll like bake one thing or like pitch in to bake something with somebody. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's usually just like cooking Christmas dinner is sort of like my big cooking thing during the holidays. Yeah, and I'm going to be doing that this year, except my brother Graham asked me if we could like kind of do something together. He like often gives me a hand when we're like cooking on the day. He's like sort of my sous chef. And but this year he asked if we could sort of like plan ahead to do some more like prep ahead of time and some more like fancy type of stuff. So okay. I think we're going to try and do a couple things. He thought it would be fun to try and make like a pate out of turkey livers.
Yep. Yeah.
I haven't used turkey livers a bunch. Do you have much experience using turkey livers? Are they pretty much like, I mean, I'm sure they probably have a bit more of a livery flavor than chicken livers, but I don't know. Have you used them a lot?
I do usually just fry the liver that we get in giblets. I haven't used it in a pate, but I've certainly like, I've used duck liver in pate. I think that my rustic pate is like one part duck liver or chicken liver to one part pork shoulder.
Right.
I would be shocked if you couldn't use turkey livers in exactly the same kind of preparation.
Yeah. So yeah, that's part of the plan is to make like a turkey liver pate. I'm sure we can get probably a bunch of turkey livers from somebody who like probably from Four Whistle Farms or something like that. If I ask Marius, I'm sure I can probably get him to give me.
Although like, he does give the giblet pack with his turkeys. So I wonder if maybe that means that he doesn't end up with a bunch of livers.
Log, yeah. I don't know. That was kind of my fear. There must be somewhere from someone from whom I can get some turkey livers. Cause I need a fair amount probably.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure larger processors must, because they sell so much turkey breast and turkey leg at like not just whole birds with giblets over the season. There must be somewhere in the province there's like a warehouse full of turkey livers.
Well, yeah, that's just it. But you can't get your hands on them because they're like pre-sold to like farmers to use as feed or something. Right. You know, all of that stuff. Like if like in the mass market, if it if they don't think it's going to be saleable, they repurpose it for something. So it's like, getting your hands on it might be kind of difficult. My
parents usually
order a turkey from Sandy View, Sandy View Farms in Spruce Grove. Mm-hmm. I wonder. I should call them, ask them if they wind up with a bunch of livers. But yeah, that's part of the plan.
As an idea, like just as a starter for a turkey dinner, is to have a little bit of pate. That's nice.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And there was another idea too. Oh yeah. He was thinking that he might be able to get a smoker from a friend of his. And so we were considering smoking the turkey. Mm-hmm. Should be fun.
You do a whole bird preparation, like you roast it whole usually?
Usually. Well, I don't know. I would say 50-50. Like sometimes I roast it whole. Pretty often I break the whole bird down and sous vide the parts. So I'll like break the whole thing down and then use the carcass, roast the carcass to make gravy. And then I'll sous vide the legs and sous vide the breasts, or I'll like roulade the breasts and then sous vide them or something. Like oftentimes I break down the bird ahead of time and then do like a few different preparations with it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, sometimes I just like put some aromatics in it and just like brine it. We always brine it. My parents usually brine it. They have like my brine recipe that I gave them like a few years ago, which I think I'm pretty much just ripped from Alton Brown. Mm-hmm. And so they usually pick up the bird and then brine it, and then they bring it to me, or I pick it up from them already brined. And then like oftentimes I'll break it down and cook it sous vide, and then roast the parts after they come out of the sous vide bath to get some color on them. Or sometimes I'll just roast the whole bird. Kind of depends how, I don't know, like doing the sous vide thing, it sounds like extra work, but on the day it's great because,
oh yeah, of course. Yeah.
You don't have to think about it at all. Like, it's just there in the bath, basically ready to go when you need it. And then, so it's like a little extra work ahead of time, but it can be very convenient. But it's also very convenient to just throw a bird in the oven and pull it out when it's dinner time. And you're like, okay, here you go, turkey. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we usually have turkey.
Yeah, like being able to precisely control your finishing temperature for the breasts and legs is obviously the most compelling reason to break the bird down beforehand. But even so, just like working, like having, being able to roast the carcass and make stock, to have like loads of turkey stock to work with during, while you're cooking the meal, is, I really love that. Like you are putting, if maybe you're making soup, but like, use it in gravy, you put it in like braised cabbage and all these other side dishes to just make it like a turkey.
Yeah. That's a huge celebration benefit to having the bird like ahead of time and breaking it down. And like, if you can find the time to like break it down and then make the stock before you're actually going to make the meal, makes such a huge difference. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I use a lot of stock in the dressing that I make. And so have your own turkey stock to put into it. Kaboom.
You have any stuffing secrets that you can share?
I mean, the secret is for me to try and make it as similar to like the stuffings that I had when I was a kid as I possibly can. Mm-hmm. And what that usually means is that it's a bread stuffing, usually. And I season it with a lot of fresh herbs, which I know wasn't really happening when I was younger, I don't think. But I season it with a lot of fresh herbs. But it's basically like bread, cream, stock, and Campbell's cream of mushroom and Campbell's cream of celery soup. That's like the stuffing recipe, the dressing recipe. You just mix that all up and put it in the oven until it's hot and you're good to go. It pretty moist. Mm-hmm. And there were a few years where I tried to fancy it up and I don't know. Nothing beats nostalgia, Alan.
Yeah, that's right.
Tried to make it more like a bread pudding or something like that, or give it different textures and stuff. But yeah, really, like in the end, it's like, I mean, I don't want it to be too dense either. So, you know, I try not to totally saturate the bread before I cook it. But, just like a lot of liquid so that it's nice and moist by the time it's done cooking, and just a ton of fresh herbs and butter and a couple cans of soup and bread and some stock. That's pretty much it.
It's interesting. I don't think anyone in my extended family would consider putting milk or cream into stuffing.
Right. Yeah, for me, it's just more to like add a little additional fat and to extend the liquid component a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
Just a little extra moisture.
It sounds like, how could that not be good? But it's just interesting that I don't think I've ever heard of that. And it wouldn't have even crossed my mind, just because, yeah, having eaten my mom's stuffing and my grandma's stuffing and all my aunt's stuffings. So it sounds like a different style for sure.
Yeah, maybe. What's your style?
The one that we make is not actually, a lot of the flavors and ingredients are similar to my mom's, but it's not like rooted in my mom's recipe. We cook like onion, garlic, bacon, mushroom.
Oh, right. Sorry, I forgot. Celery. There's a bunch of aromatics as well that I cook down ahead of time. Yeah, I forgot about that part, but yeah.
Sorry. So we'll cook bacon, and then in the bacon fat, onion, garlic, mushroom, celery. And we'll use like a seeded brown bread and toast it fairly aggressively in the oven, to get color on it. Add that to the aromatics. And then turkey stock, and cook it down with turkey stock, and then into the casserole. And
cool. Do you ever put stuffing in your bird?
No, I think I have.
I have done
once,
it, but, yeah.
once in my entire life. But yeah, the truth is that, as we have talked about, the stuffing is my favorite part of Thanksgiving and Christmas dinner. And so like the cavity of a turkey is not enough room for all the stuffing that we want to eat.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, Alan. I didn't mean to suggest that that's all of the stuffing that you would make.
Oh, okay.
Like,
you make some in the bird and then some
and then the rest that everyone's going to actually eat is like, in a pan somewhere, not inside the bird. But just the stuff in the bird is like for novelty's sake or something. But I've done it once or twice, but it's just, I don't know, it's not great for the bird. You know, like, because you have to, to cook that stuffing all the way, to get that stuffing hot all the way through when it's inside the bird, you're going to hurt the breast meat.
Yeah.
Don't do it. Don't hurt the breast meat.
And I think that this is the third time he's being mentioned by name in this conversation. I'm pretty sure that Alton Brown was doing a crusade against stuffing in the cavity of the bird when I started watching the Food Network and stuff. So I basically, like I said, I definitely tried it once, but I knew that Alton Brown didn't like it, and so I didn't do it. Basically just avoided it.
Thou shalt not defy the Alton. Yeah. Oh, what else are you going to cook for Christmas dinner? Right? Or are you just going to order KFC?
Not last year, because we were in a weird COVID place last Christmas, but for many years before that, Lisa and I would make goose for Christmas dinner.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I've made goose once or twice.
From Marius.
Yeah.
At Four Whistle Farms. And I mean, kind of treat it like the turkey, like break it down in the head, make stock. But then like the breasts we would sear, like just pan sear like a duck breast.
And the legs you would confit.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Yeah. Oh man, so good.
And it would be so like goose and mashed potato, maybe with apple in it, or just like with braised apples on the side, and lots of sage and cabbage. basically the Christmas dinner that the Cratchits have in A Christmas Carol, like just the old like roasted goose. Well, sorry, it wasn't roasted, I guess, but yeah, goose and potatoes and sage, and
it's fancy. Yeah, I've made a goose once or twice. Brussels sprouts, that's a big one.
Oh yeah, that's good. Yeah,
Yeah, I think Graham and I are going to do some kind of Brussels sprout thing. We kind of talked about that too. I'm not sure what it's going to be yet. He talked about getting a whole Brussels sprout stock, but I don't think that's really, I don't think they're around right now.
Yeah, I don't
he
think
said
so.
He's seen them in the stores around Christmas time before, and I was like, oh, really? But yeah, I kind of assumed that you had to get them closer to harvest, but I don't know. Maybe they fly them in from Mexico. What do I know?
Maybe. I don't know. That would, yeah, because they look like jingle bells.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and then
so
you
work
shake
that
it
into
like
your presentation. Yeah.
I will, yeah, for sure. That's part of the tradition. You walk around the table shaking a stalk of Brussels sprouts, pretending it's a percussion instrument. Mm-hmm. You got any Christmas baking favorites? Stuff that you make, stuff that your family makes, or?
My mom makes a few Christmas specialties, none of which I have taken on really. Mm-hmm. Like she would do a Yule log for us every year.
Damn.
What we would always have after Christmas dinner. And what else she do? There's always like the cinnamon kind of coffee cake that she made that we would have on Christmas morning. Those are the two that I remember being there every year. For me now, oh my God, I make sugar plums every year.
Oh,
it's an Alton Brown recipe.
Explain that to me. I'm not even sure if I exactly know what a sugar plum is.
Oh, is that right? It's maybe not what it sounds like. Apparently plum used to be a word that just meant like, I think that plum used to actually refer to some dried fruits, which is confusing because you think prune, but
yeah,
a sugar plum is a mixture of dried fruit and nuts. Sweetened and like maybe
that. I think maybe I've had your sugar plums before.
Almost certainly. Like if you, that solstice gathering that I mentioned, I think that you attended at least one before COVID.
At least one.
And if you were there, then you probably ate almost all the things that I've talked about tonight. We'll do, I don't know, we always have loads of dried fruit and nuts on hand. And so we'll do something like prunes and apricots and currants and sour cherries and walnuts, and then a little bit of icing sugar and lots of honey. And I like a little bit of like star anise or something, some spice component. Shape them into little balls. You can roll them in sugar if you want.
You put booze in there?
I don't, but yeah, you could definitely
go
in that direction. Yeah.
And is that supposed to be food for fairies, or what? What's the whole thing with the sugar plum fairy?
The sugar plum fairy is a character from
the Nutcracker.
From the Nutcracker, yeah.
Yeah.
So like, but I think that it's just a fanciful name. Like children would have known, children love sugar plums. And so it was like this fanciful character, the sugar plum fairy.
I see.
I think. I don't know.
So she doesn't come and steal your sugar plums. It's just like, it's a cool name for a fairy because kids love sugar plums.
I think so.
Probably.
I can't remember the name of the kingdom that she's from. If it had a running candy theme, I can't recall now.
I mean, the whole thing is actually translated from Russian, right? So probably is a whole bunch of stuff that's not actually
maybe
accurate. I don't know.
Anyways, we make sugar plums. They're tasty, and they like sweet. They seem rather wholesome in comparison to like, I don't know,
a lot of Christmas baking. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's compared to Rice Krispie squares,
there's fiber in it.
Fiber, that's good for you.
But the other baking thing, I have to admit, I don't do it every year, but especially because I think a lot of our traditions were kind of thrown off for a bit because our oldest child Cora was born on December 22nd, and so that Christmas is just like a. I don't remember it. I don't know what we did or what. But anyways, fruitcake. I love making fruitcake.
Wow. Is it good?
Yeah, but
that was a joke.
it's pretty different than the like ones on grocery store shelves with the candied pineapple.
Yeah, man, for real. Fruitcake can be delicious if it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you age yours?
We have, yeah. And the whole fruit cake project in our house, it was inspired by two things. First of all, Jeffrey Steingarten has a great essay called The Smith Family Fruitcake, which really changed how I thought about fruitcakes in general.
Okay.
But also there's this this memoir that was written by a woman who's the same age roughly as my grandmother would have been. And she grew up, she like lived in the town kind of down the road from my grandmother in Northern Ontario. And she has all these really great food memories that she shares. Mm-hmm. But she talks about the fruitcake at Christmas and how over the fall they would like collect and save all of these special ingredients, like just so that they can make fruitcake at Christmas.
Okay.
And it might be like dried muscat grapes or a certain like shelled walnuts and stuff like that. But even like the eggs from their chickens, like, cause their chickens would stop laying when the weather turned cold enough and dark enough.
Oh, really?
And so they would save the very last eggs from their chickens and preserve them by submerging them in this thing called isinglass, which I don't actually know. I think it's a kind of thick liquid.
Oh,
but they would save the eggs and do all this preparation so that they can make a cake for Christmas. And so in the same vein, we started to like, we would take some of those sour cherries that we really love at the end of summer, and we would make glacé cherries and save those for a fruitcake. We'd usually keep it fairly simple though, like in the cake itself, it would just be like glacé cherries, sour cherries, and like almonds and orange peel or something like that. Mm-hmm. But then, yeah, like make a simple kind of heavy pound cake batter, fold in those components, bake it, and then, yeah, age it. Like keep it in a container at room temperature and just like spritz it with rum every couple days or every few days. Yeah. It's fun that it's such a process and you like are waiting for it and kind of coddling it and giving it little rum baths. And yeah, it's very tasty.
Cool. Yeah. I haven't really gone down the rabbit hole of like figuring out an amazing fruitcake, and it's never really been like a top priority for me because I'm not usually in love with it. But like, mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, I have had some really good fruitcakes from people who put a lot of time and effort into them, and it can be amazing. Mm-hmm. So maybe one day, not this year though, guarantee
too
you.
Late.
Isinglass apparently is like a fish. I think from what I'm seeing, I think it's like the thing that they use to like clarify, or that they used to use to clarify Guinness.
Oh, okay.
You know how the like a few years ago Guinness had to change their recipe because it wasn't vegan?
Oh, I didn't know that. No.
And it had like something from that was some sort of like product that they used that came from fish swim bladders.
Oh, really?
To help clarify their beer. Well, apparently Isinglass is that. It's like a type of collagen or gelatin that comes from like fish swim bladders.
That's interesting because I don't know if they still do, but when I started making wine from kits at home, there was a clarifying agent called chitosan that it said on the package it contains shellfish or is a byproduct of shellfish. I wonder if that's related.
Oh, interesting. Sounds like two different things, but...
Yeah, but maybe a similar, like a seafood-based...
seafood-based clarification medium.
Yeah.
There's so many.
So, and if I remember right, that liquid, that chitosan, I don't know if that's how you say it, but... It was thick, like not like corn syrup, but much thicker than, much more viscous than water. And so I
wonder if it's similar.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure in this memoir, they just talked about like submerging the eggs in isinglass.
Yeah.
To, I guess, protect them from.
To make sure that they don't go bad.
Yeah.
I mean, eggs do pretty well. I guess, well, yeah, most of the time, I guess you would just like, the reason why they do so well now probably is because they're in the fridge a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you needed to preserve them and not keep them in the fridge, then it might be an extra layer of protection. Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool.
Yeah. But you don't do any baking, or do you have any?
Like there are several like Christmas baking related things that sometimes I involve myself in, but it's usually like my mom doing a lot of the baking, and mm-hmm. a lot of the Christmas baking is like yeah, my mom does a lot of it. And then sometimes she gets some help. Sometimes I help her. Like, for every year, for quite a while, we were making like homemade Rain Coast crisps. So like crackers with like nuts and dried fruit in them and stuff.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So I'd been doing that. Like my mom would bake the loaves and then we would like at whatever place I was working at, we would use whatever slicer we had on hand to like slice them really thin and then bake them in a deck oven. So we'd wind up with just like tons and tons of them. So that was awesome. I don't have a slicer though this year to do that with. So I don't think that that's going to happen. But yeah, my mom makes like a whole bunch of baking that like is, I don't know. It's like my whole nostalgia tradition trip around the holidays. So like, I've definitely talked about the butter tarts that she makes before.
Yes. Yeah.
On the podcast. Yeah. So that's a big one for sure. The butter tarts are great. She also makes like a cornflake toffee kind of, it's kind of like a Rice Krispie square, but it's made with like cornflakes instead. And like caramel toffee, like Macintoshes.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a big one. What else? She also always makes, why am I drawing a blank? I just had like five things in my head. every like Christmas morning. So like the night before or like Christmas Eve, she always makes like a pan of sticky cinnamon buns and puts them in the fridge, and then Christmas morning pulls them out, proofs them, and bakes them. So we always have fresh cinnamon buns on Christmas morning. That's a like a big tradition. I mean, she always makes ginger cookies. Those are amazing. I'm missing a big one. There's like a big traditional, always have it at Christmas one that it's just kind of slipping my mind right now.
So last week you alienated Ryan, your brother Ryan. And this week you're
now my mom's never going to talk to me ever again. I think I've kind of been trying to put it out of my mind a little bit because I know I'm not really going to be able to eat a whole lot of Christmas baking this year. I'm going to really have to limit my intake. So I'm kind of like trying not to think about it too much. Oftentimes like my mom or someone else, like sometimes I'll help, or when some years I've made them myself, but like someone makes tortilla every year. There's usually at least like one pre-Christmas or like, you know, early holiday meal that's like tortilla. Which I love if it's done the right way. What else? Lots of like, for the last few years, there's like a recipe on the back of the bag of what are those things called, corn puffs or popcorn twists.
Okay. Yeah,
there's like a recipe on the back of the popcorn twist bag. If you're not listening to this podcast in Canada, you probably have no clue what popcorn twists are. And there's like one brand that makes them. And it's basically like this puffed corn snack that's like super salty. Sort of like, what's the consistency like, Alan? It's sort of like,
kind of like Cheetos or no?
Yeah, except like puffy Cheetos. They're maybe slightly more dense than that. I don't know. Anyway. Yeah, there's a recipe on the back of the bag for making like caramel, like popcorn twists.
Like popcorn twists dipped in caramel?
Yeah, it's basically like caramel corn, but you use popcorn twists instead of popcorn. Yeah. So we've made quite a bit of that.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, like over the last few years and given it away as gifts and stuff like that. So many things, Alan.
Oh, man. So baking gifts at Christmas, on the street that I grew up on in Calgary and where my folks still live. There's a family friend who lives at the end of the street. She's from Basel, Switzerland. Ooh. And every December she makes hundreds and hundreds of these tiny, beautiful Swiss cookies. It's like all sorts, and they all have like there's different shapes, like there's stars and moons and other kind of more obscure Swiss shapes called one called a Basel stop, I think. And a lot of them have like it's so European. Like they'll be flavored with like lemon peel or like aniseed, and they have beautiful glazes on them. And I absolutely love them. They're like one of my, that's one of my favorite things about the season. It was interesting though. Like I had eaten those cookies for many years and then had the opportunity to visit Basel with her.
Oh, wow.
And learn a little bit about Swiss culture, mm-hmm. and eventually realized that all of those cookies, like to me, they were just like, there's like dozens of these cute little cookies. But they like every single one has a name and a history and like,
right. It probably came from a specific town.
Exactly.
Or like a specific like bakery.
Yeah. Like you can go, well, it's Europe. They go deep on everything and everything's got
awesome.
They're really beautiful. I'll show you a picture of them. Actually, I have a good one.
You're probably not going to be able to get any this year, I guess, if you're.
Well, when we go down to Calgary between Christmas and New Year's, will almost certainly be, hopefully, some there's always some at my parents' house. So
I got my fingers crossed for you, Alan.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also, when I was in Denmark, I was there over the holidays, and you know, those like blue tins of like butter cookies that you can get in like, you know, everywhere around here. That's like kind of a Danish thing.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I don't know if all of those blue tin butter sugar cookies are like supposed to be the Danish kind. But those assortments of butter and sugar cookies are like a big deal in Denmark around the holidays. Mm-hmm. And man, like the ones that we get here in those tins just pale in comparison to like, mm-hmm. the ones that I had when I was there. Even I had like tons out of tins while I was there, and they were just so good. Like, mm-hmm. oh man, just like the most delicate, like, I don't know, when you eat a butter cookie and it just sort of like turns into like butter in your mouth, and you're just like
it's
how
crispy,
is this
but
a
it's,
thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like crispy, but then it just like melts in your mouth and you're like, oh my God, this is so delicious. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're like that.
What are the, so like baked goods that you buy on a grocery store shelf? Mm-hmm. Do you have, like, it's easy to malign something like that, but like I've had quite good, say like Scottish shortbread that's been like from a box on a grocery store shelf. Do you have any favorites of those?
Yeah. Well, we always get like those Walker's shortbreads?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Those are quite good. Mm-hmm.
And you're a panettone guy. That's kind of the same thing.
I was going to bring up panettone, actually. That's on my list of things to bring up. Yeah. So I do love panettone, and I think I've talked about it on the podcast before because I watched like a whole bunch of panettone YouTube videos last year. And one in particular, the Chef Steps one, where, the host tries to emulate this, not really emulate it so much, but tries to get close to the quality of this panettone that's baked by this, basically a baker that specifically does panettone in New York.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, like it's quite a process. I don't think I'm going to have time to like try to go down that road this year, but one year. Mm-hmm. I definitely want to make a bunch of panettone. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I usually go to the Italian Center, and there's a few ones that I know are good.
Yeah.
Can't really eat much of it this year, though, so I don't know.
Right, yeah.
I'm probably going to get one and try and give most of it away and just have like a half a slice or something. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I really like the pistachio ones. Those are my fave. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Panettone with like pistachio paste in it. That's like delicious. And I find like I know it's not like... it's not actually good, but I even like the ones that you get like pre-boxed at the Italian Center. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know. There's just something about it.
Something about it.
Yeah.
For some reason, I don't know why, like speaking of Italian, mass-produced Italian sweets, Ferrero Rocher.
Oh yeah.
Is very Christmassy to me. Like we always have.
Is that Italian?
It's from, around Alba.
Oh, fancy. Ferrero.
Because that region, that region is one of the biggest hazelnut producers in the world.
Oh, well, that makes sense then.
So it's a good place to put a Ferrero Rocher factory. Yeah. But yeah, I feel like I only eat Ferrero Rocher around Christmas, but even more than Ferrero Rocher, Raffaello's, you know those ones?
Yeah, love them.
That's my big Christmas
I'm not like huge into coconut in candy most of the time, but those Raffaello's are really good. Mm-hmm. I like those. So much good stuff. I don't know how I'm going to avoid it all this year, Alan.
Can you have Christmas oranges or mandarin oranges?
Yeah, I can definitely have those. I can probably have mulled wine. There's lots of things I can have.
Yeah.
I shouldn't complain. But yeah, some of my faves, like a lot of my faves are baked goods and those, and like, yeah, I just really have to like be careful about how much baked goods I eat. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I'm definitely going to have, I mean, provided they're available, I'm definitely going to have a cinnamon bun on Christmas morning. That's right. Just like, that's an unavoidable tradition.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
I couldn't picture it. I couldn't picture not having one.
Yeah. Did you have...
Sorry, were you going to say something?
I was just going to say, what else? Do you have anything else on the list that is a must?
Well, I was wondering, do you have any, like, I don't know. I know we didn't really prepare for this, and I kind of just thought about this, like, before we just kind of right before we got on the call. But do you have you ever received any Christmas, like, any cooking-related, some any memorable cooking-related Christmas gifts that... I don't know, like you think about like when you use them around Christmas, you're like, oh yeah, this, and it like brings you nostalgia to use it, or like equipment or books or anything like that.
Certainly books. Like that's,
yeah.
Every year I ask for certain books basically. So yeah, my brother and sister have given me a lot of, fantastic books, including one of the Joe Beef cookbooks and The Art of Fermentation by Red Zeppi. And
oh, cool.
Or sorry, not The Art of Fermentation, the Noma Guide Noma to Fermentation.
Yeah.
Whatever it is. Yeah. So yeah, loads like that. In terms of equipment. Oh, I got a chinois from I mentioned once that I really needed a chinois at home. And I don't remember the story exactly, but my dad bought one in Vancouver and brought it back. And I don't know if that was because he couldn't find one in Calgary. Like he didn't go to Vancouver just to buy me a chinois. He was in Vancouver and sought out a kitchen store that had them. But anyways, that's one that I remember. What else? Do you have any?
Yeah, I got a few. I've talked about it I talked about in our Desert Island Cookbooks episode, I talked about the Morrow cookbook. That was definitely a Christmas gift from my parents. Love that book. Still love it. I don't pull it out all the time these days, but yeah, that was a really good Christmas gift. Mm-hmm. I think the first year or the second year that I was working for Elm, Nate... got me a Japanese knife. It's like,
yeah, I remember that.
A 6-inch like petty. Mm-hmm. I love that knife. I use it all the time. I take super good care of it and I keep it super sharp. And it's one of my go-to knives. I have it in my drawer at home. I use it all the time. Mm-hmm. Love that knife. I have like an enamel pan that I got. At some point, I don't even actually remember who gave that pan to me. I think it was a friend of mine when I was living in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And it was like secondhand. I think they got it from like Value Village or something. But it's like this really amazing like cast iron, like enamel cast iron pan.
Right.
Frying pan.
Yeah.
I don't use it all the time. But every once in a while, there's like the perfect thing to cook in it. And I'm just like, oh, yes. Excellent.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Also, like I've gotten several, like, you know, I'm pretty sure that the KitchenAid mixer that I have was a Christmas gift that I got from my parents.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so there are several like of the appliances that I have at home that were, I think, originally Christmas gifts. And Yeah, so quite a few. And yeah, I don't, not all of them feel like connected to Christmas or the holidays to me, but definitely the Morrow cookbook, even though there's not a ton of holiday recipes in it, that right, feels yeah. very holiday oriented to me for some reason. Every time I pick it up, I mm-hmm. think about the giftedness of it and stuff.
Right.
It's good.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know, I think, I mean, yeah, definitely several books. Like I've, you know, I often put cookbooks on my wish list, and you know, it's an yeah. easy thing to know that you can buy for a chef that, you know,
right. yeah. Yeah.
So probably half of my cookbook shelf is like Christmas gifts. Mm-hmm. If I had to guess.
Nate got me a cookbook once. Nate Box. Got me, I think it was actually the first Christmas that I worked at Elm. He got me the Favikin cookbook, which I really loved.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Have you ever cooked anything out of it? The duck? Have you cooked the duck out of it?
I can honestly say I have not cooked any recipes from that book, but I learned a lot from that book.
Exactly.
Like, there's so many interesting ideas in it. Like, for instance, I haven't tried to do this or it was just something that to add to, like I'm just storing in the back of my mind and still processing, but,
right.
Nilsson talks about, you know, the crop, you know what a bird's crop is?
Yeah.
Like a pouch at the, like basically after they swallow their food, it goes into a crop.
Yeah.
And I think some kind of lacto fermentation happens in there. But when you're cleaning game birds, like if you break that open, you'll see what the bird was eating shortly before it was shot.
Right.
And I've always been like I purposefully try to not rupture the crop because I don't want anything from the GI tract near the meat that I'm going to eat.
Right.
But Nilsson talks about like taking the items out of the crop and putting it on a stone to present alongside the finished roasted bird.
No way.
Yeah. And I can't remember if he says like, because like, if it's just like, this is what this bird eats, or if there was something about the actual aromas of it or what.
Right.
But it's just like something like that where I'm like, it just completely is so odd.
It's great. Like that book is like, and I mean, like several cookbooks that are from restaurants like that, where it's like this extreme niche, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. there's often like really very little that you can pull out of it to actually like add to your repertoire, because yes. unless you're in Sweden going to the dairy farm where he, you know, like goes and helps churn the butter that they use in the restaurant, or harvests the colostrum that they use in their colostrum dessert or whatever. Yeah. Like, you know, you can't get that. Like you can't, you know, and a lot of the ideas in that book specifically, and, you know, a lot of the other Nordic books and some other, like, I mean, even a lot of the stuff from like the El Bulli cookbooks and things like that, mm-hmm. like there's mm-hmm. very little of it that you can actually like sort of like peel out and use. Like you can, yeah, there are like philosophies and concepts that you can like kind of transpose, but like the actual dishes, like, you know.
Yeah, like for us, I think a lot of the preserving stuff he talks about translates quite well, like the yeah. like the lacto ferments and the way he preserves berries and stuff.
Oh, for sure. And like part of the reason why I wanted to go cook in Denmark was because like agriculturally and ecologically, it, you know, like it's pretty north, and mm-hmm. you know, like there's a lot of like ingredient crossover, and there's a lot of like preservation technique crossover because we're at similar latitudes, you know?
Yeah.
So like that was a big part of it for me, was that like, I thought if I was going to go anywhere, like it would be much less applicable for me to go, you know, to go work at a restaurant in like Southern Italy, because right. what am I going to bring yeah. back from there? Like, unless I live in Napa, there's, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. like, So
I agree with you. There's perhaps all, if you're a hunter here, there's a little bit more even that you would glean from that book, because they talk a lot about how they age the game birds and stuff like that. But but yeah, like you said, a lot of it is so niche and so specific to their time and place, and really probably the biggest benefits of reading that book are like seeing someone do a really deep dive on their traditional cuisine and reinventing it as one of the most famous high-end restaurants in the world at the time.
Yeah.
So yeah, that process and the kind of creativity behind it. So like I said, I don't think there are any recipes, unless it's for like preserves, that I've actually done out of the book.
Mm-hmm. Are there any reindeer recipes in that book?
Not that I remember. There's definitely moose.
Oh my God, Alan, have you seen that TikTok of that reindeer that's running beside that train? Oh no, my God. It's so amazing. I'm going to put it in the show notes for sure. Okay. So when we publish the episode, you go into the episode and I'll find a link to that. Oh my God, it's so amazing. So this is like reindeer running full tilt, like alongside of this train and just trucking. It looks so, oh man, it's so funny.
Yeah.
It's the best. Yeah. I've never cooked any reindeer and caribou are the same thing. Is that right?
I was just going to, so all of my natural, like my, what's the word? Like ecology and animal knowledge now is coming from my daughter's television shows.
Oh yeah.
And, what is it? Oh, okay. So there's a show that she watches called Wild Kratts, hosted, like created by the Kratts brothers. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
Nope.
And they say specifically in this one episode that reindeer and caribou are different species. However, at the Edmonton, the Valley Zoo in Edmonton, one of the placards in front of their reindeer says that reindeer, or like caribou, are the Canadian version of reindeer, or that they're, this implies that they're the same. So I don't know if they're like the same species.
So same genus, but different species.
Well, I don't know if what the actual case is, if it's a different species or if it's like a breed within a species or what. But
well, I don't know. Isn't that what a species is? It's like it's basically the same animal, except it's maybe like in a different location, so it has slightly different like adaptations, but it's like a different version of a similar animal or something.
Like you can have subspecies that are technically the same species, but have different adaptations. So like, for instance, like bison, like the species is, the genus and species is bison. But we talk about like, there's like plains bison and woodland bison, that are adapted to the two different climates, like the southern, like open
grasslands. And so those are subspecies. They're not different species.
Yeah. And they can interbreed, but they do have different adaptations. Yeah.
Right.
I haven't cooked caribou or reindeer, but the last couple of weeks I have been working with venison, with whitetail and mule deer.
Oh, cool.
And going on these kind of, the only way I had that meat before was like, you would take the lean cuts, take all of the fat off the outside and roast lean meat.
Yeah.
I, at Kevin Kosowin's suggestion, started working with the fat. Like he was cooking some venison confit, like in venison fat.
Right. Leg or?
Neck is what he was doing.
Oh yeah, cool.
Neck and shoulder. But the fat is so crazy. Like it is like candle wax. Like when you render it, first of all, like I took a bunch off of this piece I was cutting, and typically to render fat, I'll grind it and then I'll put it in a pot with a little bit of water, low heat, and let it render out. First of all, the raw fat tripped the breaker on my grinder because it's so hard.
Oh, wow.
So I had to I warmed the fat gently in the oven just to get it through my grinder.
Yeah.
And then rendered it on the stove. And it is seriously like, once it's rendered and cooled to room temperature, it's like candle wax. Like it doesn't melt in your mouth.
It's just like hard.
It's like wax. Yeah. Like it does.
Wow. It's like extra saturated.
Yeah. And cool. so it, it tastes good. And like when it's hot, it, you don't notice anything like that. But I was worried about working in it with it in my kitchen, like putting it, any of it down the drain seemed like it would be like melting a candle and dumping it down the drain. But
you shouldn't put that down the drain anyways, Alan. So
No. But like even just like washing, say washing the grinder components in the sink.
Yeah, yeah. Totally.
Once the dishwater cooled down enough, I could see the flecks of waxy fat floating on the surface of the water. And like the water's still warm to the touch, but it's below the melting point of the fat.
Wow, that's crazy.
So anyways, that was an interesting, a new experience for me this week.
How'd it turn out? Delicious? Did you use neck? Did you get some?
I haven't. I just rendered the fat in the last few days. Okay. But I haven't tried cooking confit yet, but I've got the fat the meat in the freezer. So.
Did you get sides or did you get whole animals and where did they come from?
I guess like a forequarter of mule deer and a hind quarter of whitetail.
Whitetail?
Mule deer, doe, and whitetail buck. And I don't know exactly where they were harvested. I think that mule deer are more common in southern Alberta, but you can certainly still hunt them here, I think.
Yeah.
I'm out of my depth. I don't actually know all the details.
Yeah, fair enough.
Excited to cook, and they really like make, and we made stock. So like rendering the fat and making the stock, it really did smell not so different than like the grass fed beef that we work with, or like the pastured, like grass fed lambs that we've bought in the past. Those should be good.
Cool. Exciting. Do you want to join me in wishing everyone happy holidays?
Yeah.
3, 2, 1.
God bless us, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.
Happy holidays!